high of 49. Normal high this time of year, 47. Here are the numbers now. A little breeze from the northeast at 3. 35 Kenosha, 31 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tonight on the PBS series American Experience, yet another superb documentary film is airing that I urge you to watch. I learned so much from taking a preview peek at a film called Change Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is a piece of legislation that was truly groundbreaking and life-changing, and also a long time coming, and only came after a supreme struggle. And it is one more way in which the notion of civil rights has been expanded for all of us. Not completely, not perfectly, but in a way that was truly significant. And I am so excited to be able to speak with the woman who was both writer and producer for this wonderful documentary film, Shana Gazit. She is responsible for 8 or 9 previous American Experience films, including The Pill, Codebreaker, Dust Bowl, and others. I've had the pleasure of speaking with her before on The Morning Show, and I'm excited to speak with her today about this film, which again airs tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. Change Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Shana Gazit, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be speaking with you.
So, as so often when I talk to documentarians under these circumstances, I want to begin by asking you, was this your idea or someone else's idea that American Experience would be a great showcase for this particular story?
Well, it was really the idea was brought to me by Cameo George, who's the executive producer of American Experience, which is kind of just a fabulous history series on PBS. And the way she presented it was that it was going to be a film about the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was, you know, a piece of legislation that I knew very little about. And I thought, oh, wow, that's going to make an interesting film, a film on a piece of legislation. Well, it turned out, one, like, I couldn't believe that such an important history of the 20th century was something that I knew virtually nothing about. And though I had heard about the ADA, had no idea of its how extraordinarily important and powerful it was. So for me, it was really a journey of discovering a history which I think we all need to know about.
Absolutely. And early in the film, a statistic is shared that really staggered me, that being that 1 in 4 Americans at the time that this passed in 1990, 1 in 4 Americans were living with some sort of disability. And and when one considers that, then it becomes even more important that there be legislation like this, and it becomes, in a sense, even more shocking that such legislation hadn't already existed long before.
Absolutely. I mean, we started in a period of time where you had so many World War II veterans and veterans of the Korean War and Vietnam War that had become disabled. On top of that, we were really on the heels of the polio epidemic. So by virtue of that, the number of people with disabilities had really skyrocketed. But I think to your point, and the more important point, is that some of us are born with disabilities, some of us acquire it for whatever set of unfortunate circumstances, and most of us will age. So it really is, disability is something that affects all of our lives.
Right. And sooner or later, as you are suggesting, we will ourselves even become disabled if that is not already a part of our lives. And certainly somebody we know, and almost certainly somebody we love, is going to be living with some kind of disability. And that makes this all the more important. I want to make sure to take a moment to talk about an interesting choice that I assume you made as the writer and producer of this film, and that is to set, in contrast to the Americans with Disabilities Act, something very familiar to especially Americans of a certain age, namely the famous telethon that would air year after year around Labor Day, headlined by Jerry Lewis. Certainly a well-meaning, charitable undertaking, and yet something that was not necessarily always fully embraced or appreciated or welcomed by at least some people in the disabled community. I think it's an interesting and maybe even a bold choice, given the fact that probably some Americans have very kind of warm and fuzzy memories of these telethons and the money raised to combat muscular dystrophy. But clearly you thought it was important to kind of raise this as sort of another way, and maybe a sometimes unfortunate way, to think about disability. Talk for a moment about this important moment in the film.
Well, I was one of those people of a certain age that grew up with the Jerry Lewis telethon and thought they were, you know, wonderful and kind and empathetic and kind of the best that you human beings can do for each other. So it, for me, it was a real, you know, kind of enlightenment to know that that many, if not most, in the disability community hated the telethons. They hated the use of pity to raise money. As many have said to me, can you imagine, you know, going for a job interview the day after the telethon? That it really painted disability as something that should be pitied, and that there was a kind of hopelessness in disability.
Right.
That only this charity would be able to alleviate. I should also clarify that, at least up to this point in my life, I've not had a disability. The director of this film, Jim LeBrec, who's this kind of brilliant filmmaker, has been in a wheelchair all his life. And so I went through as much of a personal transformation of my own attitude and understanding of disability in this film as I hope others will feel watching the film.
Right. There is another really striking moment as well I want to mention, and this is one of the guests we hear from quite a lot, and that is Cindy Jones, the publisher of Mainstream Magazine, and she, as a young girl, was a poster child for the March of Dimes, as someone who suffered from polio, and the story is told of how a new flyer had come out from the March of Dimes on which she was prominently featured, and her teacher was excited, her schoolmates were excited, she was excited, and then she saw this flyer, and there are two young people running through a field, and then on the opposite side is a picture of young Cindy with crutches, And the headline is basically this, pointing to the two healthy children, and then not this, over the picture of young Cindy with crutches. And she herself, many years later, shares how devastating it was for her to see herself portrayed in that way. It's an incredibly illuminating moment in the film. I think it gets a lot of us thinking about something that perhaps we might look at and not have any any sort of reservations about whatsoever. And she sees that, of course, through different eyes.
Absolutely. So this was a poster to promote the polio vaccine. And but so the this versus Cindy, not this, made her feel like, you know, that she should be erased from the face of the earth, really. That nobody wanted to be like her. That she had no kind of inherent worth as part of society. And she has said to me on a number of occasions, and I thought I was really cute. So this really did come as a shock and a pain that would last for her lifetime. You know, it's somebody else in the film says the kind of feeling at the time was that people with disabilities should be kept out of sight. And so it was out of sight, out of mind as public policy. And that's the question that Cindy asked, is what were we supposed to do? You know, we were just feeling like we should be kept out of sight and out of mind.
Could you say just a word about something that is mentioned early in the film that speaks directly to that? And that is that for a time in our country, there were on the books something that, of course, now we can only view with terrible regret and shame, and that is the presence of certain laws that came to be known as ugly laws, which referred to people with disabilities, and especially very visible, let's say, upsetting disabilities, and what these laws would, in a sense, suggest be done with such people.
So yes, the ugly laws. Who knew about the ugly laws? You know, but yet, even though we didn't know about them, kind of the attitudes and the feelings that they represent really stayed with us. So across the country, there were various ordinances that said that if you had some sort of visible disability, you should not be in public. You know, it was kind of against the law to be in public. And you, once again, you can imagine what that does to anybody's sense of self-worth in the society. We use a clip in the film at some point from The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is really about someone with a disability desperate to join and be part of the society at large and cannot. And the kind of loneliness and shame and desperation that leaves. It's kind of extraordinary that these laws existed. Now, the way these attitudes kind of perpetuated is that for many decades, doctors would advise parents to institutionalize their children, that the best thing to do for the children, but more importantly, the best thing to do for the family, is to keep these children away, locked up, out of sight.
It was really interesting to me to see an excerpt from what seems to have turned the tables here, or at least begun that process, namely an expose done by one Geraldo Rivera, a figure who is often and soundly and perhaps rightly criticized for certain excesses in the kind of journalistic work that he did. But one has to applaud him for a film that sort of revealed desperately terrible situation, living situation at the Willowbrook State School, which housed a number of disabled youngsters. And this began, from the sounds of it, a national conversation, at least in certain quarters, about how we should view the disabled.
It shocked the nation. It shocked the nation because living in a world of, you know, out of sight, out of mind, to be able to be taken into an institution like this, which was kind of the largest in the country, with condition, as a person in the film says, conditions that would be acceptable in a zoo right now. Just was really a moment of just coming out of the shadows. And the disability advocacy had been building, especially, you know, by those parents of, children who had been left disabled by polio, and, of course, veterans as well. And so it had been building slowly, but the Willowbrook just kind of was a sea change. And it really kind of gave just the emotional force and willpower to find another way for living with disability in this society. Mm-hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Shana Gazit, writer and producer of a fascinating documentary film airing tomorrow night on PBS called Change, Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. It tells the story of the long struggle for passage of some sort of federal legislation that would ensure fair treatment of those living with disability. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but one thing that I was intrigued by in your film was when you make mention of something that occurred in 1973 with a revision of I believe a bit of legislation called the Rehabilitation Act, and at the very end of it, in something called Section 504, were 46 words that essentially barred discrimination against the disabled. And this was a groundbreaking move, but done without any fanfare whatsoever. The film makes it sound like maybe just sort of after the fact it was sort of stumbled upon that this had been passed. And of course, because it was not rigorously enforced, it didn't really do much in terms of changing people's lives, except for perhaps arousing new interest around this issue. Could you just say a quick word about how such a thing happened? I mean, did it happen by accident, or do we really know anything about why these 46 innocent-sounding words were added to this legislation and passed without very much fuss or even discussion? Apparently,
I really don't know the precise answer to that, but I can say that there was certainly some very good attorneys with civil rights background working on this legislation. And as you said, it was a real milestone because it was the first time that disability was associated with discrimination. And why that's so important is because up to that moment, disability was thought of as a medical condition. And you help people with disabilities by helping them in a medical way. And so this was a real kind of change of the prism altogether. and really initiated the idea that disability rights were civil rights. So the concept of civil rights for people with disabilities was really born in that very kind of innocuous moment. And it would be the thing that the movement then really kind of builds on to pressure for the passage of the ADA. And the one thing I really want to say is that for me, one of the most important and perhaps kind of a uplifting part of the story is that the passage of the ADA is really about the power of a grassroots movement. I mean, these were people with disabilities, some quite serious, that were literally willing to put their bodies on the line to make their voices heard. And it was this grassroots people's movement that more than anything else is responsible for the passage of the legislation. Having said that, though, I think the thing that is kind of remarkable as well is that this was really a bipartisan effort. Both Republicans and Democrats came together. It wasn't easy, and it took a lot of work, but they came together to pass this momentous legislation. So it really is this kind of shining example of democracy at work.
Mm. One of the things
and
that
I was going to say, and how to get things done.
Right, exactly. One of the things that we're told is that it is one thing to make your way one way or another to Washington, D.C. It's another thing to be able to get inside the door of the offices of the people who can move the needle and make a difference. And so part of the story is of how some of these disabled folks, part of this movement, were able to gain access to really important people, or people at least adjacent to really important people, in order to get movement accomplished. There are all kinds of different aspects of the movement as well that are interesting, including a couple of groups who are, let's say, especially militant in their approach, such as a group called ADAPT, who were especially interested in changing public transportation to make it more accessible. And the lengths to which they went to have their message be heard was really quite extraordinary.
It is. It's such a story of courage. And when I say put their bodies on the line, I really mean put their bodies on the line. A story of courage and resolve and determination that is quite moving and quite uplifting. And you pair that with the DREDF, the defense fund that was created for disability rights. And what you have in that group is some also, I mean, kind of, we happen to focus on three women who were quite young at the time, but brilliant political strategists. And so by the time they get to Washington, you know, they're, as you said, able to really kind of get into the kind of inner workings of Washington politics. But they do that because they're really kind of brilliant at it, brilliant strategists, and know kind of how to or learn how to work the system. So there's much, I think, for us to take away from the story, not only in a kind of a personal way and a human way. By the way, the ADA has really benefited all of us. And I, you know, whether it's curb cuts or automatic doors or, you know, it really, we don't even think about it, but this is all because of the ADA.
Right.
So, you know, there's much we can take away from for and be inspired by for a present day.
Mm. And of course, I think one of the things I love about your film is that we get such a sense of how tremendously exciting and meaningful it is for not only the three women that you especially showcase, but others part of this movement. I mean, when one thinks about what that so much of their life had been about being excluded and left out, there's such a poignant moment when we see a class photo from some high school someplace, and here is most of the class sitting in the bleachers of, we presume, that school's football stadium, and down front, slightly off to the side, not up in the stands because it's impossible, is one young woman in a wheelchair. And without any grandiose voiceover or anything, it's just a very graphic example of what it means to be excluded. And for these folks contending with various disabilities to be at the heart of and soul of this movement on behalf of themselves and others, I mean, how incredibly empowering that had to be. I mean, we get a palpable sense of that from your film.
Well, if I can just continue the story about the photograph of that young woman, the amazing Mary Lou Breslin, she tells a story in the film, and again, as kind of the most concrete way to illustrate a before and an after the ADA, she talks about all those years in school where she couldn't use the bathrooms because they were not accessible to somebody in a wheelchair. So she learned for years to go out into the parking lot, you know, and kind of pull her wheelchair, near a car and, you know, do what she needed to do. I mean, the idea that she couldn't even use a bathroom to go to school is really an example of the kind of prison that people with disabilities lived with before the ADA. It's kind of, in some ways, the easiest to imagine, whether it's a mobility disability, then, you know, kind of deaf or blind, but many with mobility disabilities were essentially trapped in their homes. I mean, they could barely go around the block in their wheelchairs without, you know, people lifting them off the sidewalk onto so they could cross the street. And so the idea that they could live such a imprisoned life, and that ADA just like opened the gates to really participating in the larger society for all that they have to contribute creatively, economically, you know, in every way, is what makes the ADA so monumental.
Mm. Well, your film does an amazing job of showcasing and chronicling the long struggle, and it was a struggle. There was a time when opponents to the ADA called it the bankruptcy bill because, of course, of the expense that would be incurred by businesses large and small and other concerns at times when the national mood was moving away from regulation, stepping away from this kind of regulation seemed to be a very natural course of action. But those in favor of the ADA fighting desperately for its passage did not relent in their efforts, and they could not be ignored. And ultimately, of course, this is passed. And your film climaxes with that scene with President H.W. Bush signing this into law and saying, let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down. It's a remarkable story. It's an important story for all of us to know. And one of your guests says, I think so beautifully in the closing minutes of the film, the ADA is the ceiling, not the ceiling, it is the floor. That is, this is just a start, and that there is more work to be done to achieve true equity and inclusion. And so your film gives us so much to think about.
Yeah, and to preserve what's here as well. So, you know, we'd like to keep the ADA intact.
All of that and more explored in this important film called Change Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. It will air tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. This film written and produced by Shana Gazit. Shana Gazit, thank you so much for creating this important film, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much. This was so such an important and lively conversation, and I thank you.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program comes from the Morning Show Archives, an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2013. In this portion of the Morning Show, we celebrate soup. And isn't it a beautiful kind of food? Soup is something around which we gather sometimes when we need so-called comfort food in the worst way. Soup is often what we turn to when there are wonderful leftover ingredients that are just waiting to be combined in intriguing ways. And soup is often a way in which we can gather with friends, gather with family, and share soups, combine soups, and have wonderful times together in a way that maybe is not quite possible with any other kind of food. There's something very special about soup, and it is celebrated in a beautiful way in a new book called Soup Night, Recipes for Creating Community Around a Pot of Soup. The author is from Portland, Oregon, Maggie Stuckey, author of The Bountiful Container, and she knows a great deal about gardening, about delicious foods, and a great deal about soup. And in fact, this book is not only a collection of all kinds of wonderful soup recipes, but also a collection of stories about various groups around the country who are engaging in soup nights in which soup is shared and enjoyed together in all kinds of different settings. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Maggie Stuckey for a few minutes about her book, again called Soup Night. Maggie Stuckey, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
I'm really, really happy to talk to you. I want to mention that I was in Portland, Oregon, your hometown, well, not where you're originally from, but where you live now, for the very first time within the last year, and I was so impressed. It was wonderful to be to Portland after finally having heard so much about it. And
was it raining?
It rained a little bit, but part of it.
That's what everybody knows about Portland, that it rains all the time.
Well, you are a gardener of some renown, so you probably appreciate the moisture to some extent.
We do.
So, you have had some interesting experiences with soup yourself, and at some point, you obviously were inspired to write a whole book about soup. Tell us where you got the idea of devoting this kind of time and space specifically to soup.
Well, I was invited to a soup night here in my hometown.
Is that a Stanton Street soup night?
It is, yes. It's the block where my brother and his family live. And my niece, Meg, just happened to mention it in passing. I said, hold on, back up a second, tell me about soup night. And what she was describing sounded so wonderful, I got myself invited. And the first time I went there, I was so enchanted by what they have done on this one block. Everybody on the whole block, both sides of the street, corner to corner, gets together once a month for soup, and they have created an amazing community out of people who, in the normal course of events, probably wouldn't form any particular bond. because that it's a highly urban setting with all the different demographic constituencies that you can imagine in a big city, and people who wouldn't maybe normally become good friends, they have, because they get together once a month with the deliberate intention to get to know each other and to be a really close neighborhood. Because they do this, there's something about, you touched on this yourself in the beginning, Greg, something about sitting down and sharing a meal with people you don't know or don't know well that just moves the whole experience to something else. And they have, it's absolutely wonderful. It's so amazing. You can kind of stand on the sidewalk and feel it in the air that there's something really special there. So after I spent some time with them and watched how wonderful this all is and how very cool it is and how much fun they have together, I thought maybe it would be interesting to see if I could find a couple of other groups in other parts of the country. And without very much trouble, I found 30 of them, including one in Milwaukee, by the way, that do with the same general yearning to live in an area where neighbors know each other and help each other out and take care of each other. They amazingly enough hit upon the very same idea of how to accomplish that, which is somebody said, well, let's have a big pot of soup and get everybody together.
I noticed when you described the Stanton Street soup nights specifically, and I think you maybe even used this phrase as you described it, but I love it. I want to use it again.
Okay.
That every single person, corner to corner, on both sides of the street, is invited.
Yes.
I mean, this is intended for to be that inclusive. I'm just curious, in the case of the Stanton Street soup nights, does just about everybody come? I mean, it's certainly important that everybody is invited. In fact, does just about everybody come, usually?
Yes, just about everybody. There are a couple of families who don't usually attend, but they're always invited because the hope is that someday they will come. There are a couple of families that have very young children, and so it's not always possible for them to do, but almost everybody comes all the time. In fact, Greg, it happens like this. If they get another invitation, they'll say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't do that. It's soup night, and we never miss it.
So as you went about looking for other such examples of soup nights, it sounds like you were happily surprised that you easily became aware of so many others. It would seem to indicate that a fair number of people across the country are engaged in something at least roughly similar to this lovely tradition in this neighborhood in Portland.
I was happily surprised. What surprised me was that without talking to each other, because, you know, they don't know each other exists, that, number one, they all had the same feeling that they didn't want to live among strangers. They wanted to live where neighbors knew each other. But when they thought about how they would go about accomplishing that, they all came up with the same idea. And it speaks to the power of soup, which is so simple. It's easy to create. It's warm and nourishing. It's the ultimate comfort food. I mean, didn't we all love chicken noodle soup when we were sick as a kid? That instantly made us feel better when Mom came in with that. Even now, soup makes us feel good in so many ways.
I want to touch on a couple of things that are in a list that I just love in Chapter 1, which is called The Glory of Soup.
Okay.
And so you mention all kinds of things, including the fact that particularly if we want it to be, soup can be very, very healthy, can be very, very inexpensive. And there are other things that you said about soup that I think are worth just expanding upon. For instance, that soup is versatile. In what way is soup versatile?
Well, you can use it in so many ways. You can use it as a first course to a dinner party. You can use it as a quick lunch when you're starving and you don't have anything ready to go. You can use it as a dessert. There's some wonderful fruit soups that make a lovely dessert. especially in the summertime when fruit is so yummy. But more than that, it allows for all kinds of adaptations. If you're looking at a soup recipe and it calls for something you don't have, well, you just leave it out, or you use something that's kind of similar and you use that instead. You talked about, you know, leftovers that are just crying out to be combined into a soup. The magic of soup, in my opinion, is you can put anything, absolutely anything, in a soup pot, and it's always going to be wonderful. It's versatile because anybody can do it. That makes it easy. It sort of opens up avenues for all kinds of creativity.
In fact, another item on that little list that I love is soup is forgiving.
Yeah.
And I think what you were saying there is something to the effect that precision of measurements really doesn't matter all that much when it comes to soup. That there is room for, in a sense, miscalculation and happy accidents in soup. It's just something you can work with.
Put it, happy accidents, that's perfect.
You also have some advice in this very same chapter in how to set up one's so-called soup pantry. So in a sense, you could really be poised and ready to create a whole array of wonderful soups. Just give our listeners a couple of quick bits of advice on amply stocking their own soup pantry.
Sure. Well, canned tomatoes, canned beans, which you want to rinse because a lot of them have maybe a little more sodium than you would want in your soup. All kinds of pasta. But the small pastas that would fit in a spoon easily, like, you know, the curves you use for mac and cheese and the little seashells, a good quality chicken or beef or vegetarian stock that, you know, comes in cans in the supermarket. And then your favorite herbs and spices, particularly if you're cooking for vegetarians, you can pump up the flavor by adding some unusual herbs. I've organized the book into four seasons. So in addition to the pantry, most people have in their refrigerator what's fresh that season. So you maybe got a couple of carrots, you got one lemon, you've got a half of a winter squash, anything that's in your refrigerator. So what I like to imagine is somebody opens up the refrigerator, pulls out a couple of things, says, I need a different base, and goes to the pantry and pulls out a can of chopped tomatoes with chili, maybe, and a half a teaspoon of good chicken stock, and there you go, you're on your way.
Mm. I know that one of the hallmarks of the soups that you like to create are indeed those fresh vegetables right out of your wonderful garden. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you maybe have one or two vegetables to which you especially like to turn when it comes to making soup, and maybe one that might be surprising to the rest of us.
I don't know that it'd be surprising, because we always sort of tend to turn to the familiar with soup. There's absolutely nothing, of course, like homegrown tomatoes. If you have a garden, and I do my gardening in containers because that's the kind of place I live in, and so I always make space to grow a few tomatoes, because there's just absolutely nothing like it. Once you have taste a tomato that was allowed to stay on the plant until it's dead ripe, you won't ever want to buy anything from the supermarket again. So tomatoes, I grow garlic chives, which is a plant that it is related to the regular chives, but it has a little bit of a garlic flavor, and a beautiful little white flower. I like to use flowers as garnishes in soups. It takes people by surprise, especially kids. They say, "You mean I can eat that?" I have nasturtiums growing, and I float nasturtium flowers in a soup, especially if it's a green soup like spinach, like a cream of spinach in the springtime, with an orange nasturtium flower or petals floating on top of it.
And then, of course, this book brings before us a whole array of stupendous-looking recipes. There's one after another. I'm especially excited to try the ginger chicken soup, which looks wonderful, the asparagus leek chowder, the chicken artichoke soup. And we should mention that your book is not only full of wonderful soup recipes, but you have recipes about other things as well, which can be a lovely enhancement to any meal that involves soup.
Yes, there are 99 soup recipes and then 40 others which are pretty evenly divided between salads, breads, and desserts, things that you would eat with soup if you were making a whole supper. And I should also mention, Greg, that the recipes largely came from people who participate in these soup groups around the country. And don't you know, they gave me their very best recipes, so they're quite wonderful. And because they come from different regions, we have different regional specialties represented. We have pozole from Tucson and gumbo from Louisiana and four different kinds of chili, one in every season. And just lots of interesting ethnic twists to certain soups and regional flavors.
It is a wonderful book, start to finish, and it helps us think about soup and maybe appreciate it, because for as lovely as soup is, it's also something that, because of its relative simplicity, we can sometimes take for granted a bit. And I don't think that's possible once we have read your book and thought about the way in which soup could be a different part of our lives. And maybe we could be the part of starting some sort of a soup night of our own. Have you had any sense that your book has been inspiring in that respect?
I have heard from several people who've said, you know, I don't know my neighbors. I wish I did. This is a great way to do it. And if you and I were talking this time next year, Greg, and there were 2,000 soup groups around the country, I could not be happier.
You just sort of have the sense that the world would be a better place somehow
absolutely.
If that were true. So when I go home tonight, what would you suggest I turn to for the first recipe to make out of your book?
Well, I'm going to mention one that's a favorite of mine, and it's in my mind because I just made it last night. It's called African peanut soup, which is the chicken and rice and tomato base, but then you stir in about a half a cup of peanut butter. When I say that, a couple of people say, really? Because they automatically think of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. It's not that kind of taste at all. It's just, it adds an unusual kind of surprising depth of flavor, and of course adds extra protein. So if you wanted to make a vegetarian version of the soup, it would be very easy to do. It's got a little curry powder in it, so it's got that kind of smokiness, and then this peanut butter that makes people say, what is this I'm tasting? And I try to make them guess, and they can never figure it out.
I just might try that. In the meantime, we direct our listeners to seek out your wonderful book, which is again called Soup Night, Recipes for Creating Community Around a Pot of Soup, and its author, Maggie Stuckey. Maggie Stuckey, I've so enjoyed this. The book is lovely, and I have a strong suspicion it will be an inspiring book for a lot of people. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we talk about a very special series of performances taking place at Carthage College this coming weekend, the next iteration of the Verbatim Theater Project at Carthage, presented by the Theater Department. And this is called Terminal Exhale, and it shares stories of frontline healthcare workers and what it is like for them to deal with and minister to victims of gun violence. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. And don't forget the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today will be mostly sunny, and a high temperature today of 49 degrees, and not quite as windy as yesterday. Clear skies overnight, but cold with a low of 28. Sunny tomorrow and again a high of 48 degrees. On Thursday, with a few clouds rolling in, we'll actually warm to the upper 50s and to the upper 60s by Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.